Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
This is episode 8 or 9 of The Greatest Scientist. I'm just reading through a coffee table book, which is sort of picked out sort of the famous list of scientists, sort of like the dream team of scientists throughout the ages, color-coded in different eras, so you can go back to it. There's sort of not an overarching theme. The treatment of quantum mechanics is just eye-wateringly inadequate. I think they've sort of sucked on the inadequacy of the Copenhagen School, and that's led to them down through a few dead ends. They've covered a few people. There's always some interesting stuff. The fact that Erwin Hubble was from California, or from where he was, went to the UK for a few years and adopted a UK accent and a jacket and a pipe. He did an awful American impression of a UK scientist to get back into California to differentiate himself. That's something that's, you know, just vomit-inducing. Okay, Linus Pauling. It's a chap I really like and I find interesting, and he died in 1994, which is interesting. Linus Pauling is considered one of the most influential chemists since Lavoisier and the founding father of molecular biology. His work on chemical bonds, forces, and holds the atoms together in molecules and crystals form the basis of understanding molecular structures. I have to do say so. However, if you imagine that's sort of back of the envelope, creating the language. However, we now have supercomputer models where the bonds are just what they are, and it really is a supercomputer thing. So you can make some guesstimates based on esoteric information and ideas, but there's really nothing like a supercomputer. So I've used supercomputers to investigate bond lengths and stuff like that, in some fairly hairy situations, and really Linus Pauling is good for lectures and stuff like that. I love the man. Let's read about him. Although Linus Pauling played a key role in unravelling chemicals that make life possible, this is only half the story. He was also a great humanitarian and a devoted worker for the world peace and civil liberties. He won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry in 1954 for his work on the chemical bond, and 1962 the Nobel Peace Prize for making the first person to win two unshared Nobel Prizes. Oh, well, there you go. Pauling, unlike most great scientists, is not famous for one or two key discoveries. Instead, his influence extended far and wide, and you can think of him, perhaps, as stitching together all major works of the 20th century in chemistry and biochemistry. There's Linus Pauling and Wolfgang Pauli, the Pauli exclusion principle. Pauling, he's got some pretty hairy New Age theories dovetailed in there. What if they do? Linus Carl Pauling's childhood is unsettled and marked by poverty and tragedy. He was born in Portland, Oregon, the 28th of February, 1901. His father, failed pharmacist of German descent, who died when Pauling was only 9 years old. Thereafter, his mother brought up her three children on her own. Pauling had to work from the age of 13 to help support his family. Despite this hardship, Pauling was a bright... Now, this is, you know, like the if you had to say, well, this is archetypal Faraday, and reading from that, I say instantly, well, he's a Faraday type, and I think, say, like this sort of simplistic view of Faraday in this book doesn't allow you to see the similarities between the two. He showed early interest in science, particularly chemistry, and loved experimenting in a small laboratory that a friend, Lloyd Jeffress, kept in the bedroom. So I similarly had a fake wall behind my room and had a chemistry laboratory behind it. But Pauling failed again in his high school diploma because he refused to take American history course in the way the school required. The diploma was withheld until after he won two Nobel Prizes when the school finally relented. Isn't that beautiful? At high school, when Pauline went to Oregon State Agricultural College's Culver's in 1917 to study chemical engineering, his mother was living in poverty and Pauline had to work a full time while studying. From 1919 to 1920, he taught the course in analysis that he'd just finished taking, earning him the epithet of the boy professor. Now, this is again really interesting that he is teaching and also Mendeleev's teacher. It was all that saved him from having to leave and return to Portland to support his mother. And sort of, I don't know, similar to me, I'm reserved to fund my way through university. So it's amazing. Not really. After finishing his degree, he moved to California Institute of Technology, Caltech, in Pasadena, where he taught from 22 to 25 and gained a PhD in chemistry in 1925. And what I was wanting to say is that Caltech was in Pasadena. I'm just trying to remember it, but if you really read into depths, these great things come across Caltech. Who is his name? Milken oil drop experiment. The Milken was important in Caltech. And you've got to understand that some of these great institutions with great people are not the old institutions. Bohr being sponsored by a beer company. Now, his institute was funded by beer money. In 1923, he married Ava Helen Miller, a brilliant young woman who he met and fell deeply in love with while teaching a course in chemistry for home economics. Ava was a passionate campaigner for women's rights and later worked with Pauline on his campaigns against nuclear arms together. They had three sons and a daughter. And this is beautiful. And it's interesting, like the professor, oh, I'm teaching home economics. Imagine mixing, breaking eggs. And Pauline teaching a home economics course. What the heck? Atoms and bonds. Already in 1919, Pauline was interested in atoms and bonds with one another. It was become the main thrust of his career. So he's got electronegativity, where that sort of falls out rather neatly, but it's not a very powerful. At the end, there's the Pauling number. Let's see what he says. He was inspired by the work of Irving Langmuir, and Gilbert Lewis, the Lewis dot diagrams. And now, of course, Lewis dot diagrams is just complete bogus. He suggested that pairs of electrons shared between atoms, holding the atoms together. Pauling began to work to crystalline structures in Caltech in 22, hoping to find out why atoms arrange themselves into regular patterns. Pauling had learned about X-ray diffraction as a student and used it to determine the crystalline structure of molybdenum in 1922. So molybdenum has a real interesting, so it must be molybdenum then technetium, just going through my head. And molybdenum did play a part in many points Italians got the Americans to unwittingly post them a molybdenum foil that they had exposed to neutrons, and they discovered technetium and stuff like that. Molybdenum is very interesting and also key lubricant. When in X-rays were directed at the crystal, some were knocked off course while others passed. This makes me vomit. I'll read this statement to you. Some are knocked off course by striking atoms, while others pass straight through as if there's no atoms in the path. This person is just beyond scope dumb. Has he not even been to high school? Well, this diffraction wave properties. Result is a diffraction pattern, a pattern of dark light and dark lines that reveals the position of the crystal. Well, no, this is bright and dark spots, and a sphere. I've forgotten what they call the sphere. Is a angular momentum sphere. Pauling studied many more crystals, and in 28 published his findings and set of rules working out the probable crystalline structures from X-ray diffractions. Inspiration from Europe. After completing his PhD in 25, Pauling travelled to Europe for 2 years to the Guggenheim Fellowship where he worked with some of the most influential figures of the day, Niels Bohr, Erwin Schrödinger, and James William Bragg. I think Bragg was an Australian myself. Most inspirational for him, though, from the observation of the works of Fritz London and Walter Helton. So we've got London factors for bonding, for a London potential. On their quantum mechanics of the hydrogen atom. And this is pretty amazing that they're getting all bond lengths from quantum mechanics. Just back of the envelopes, brilliant bond lengths. Returning to the United States, and these are 1931 bond lengths and papers, and you go to research it, there's nothing. You have to go right back to these papers, and they do this really hard quantum mechanics where you say, oh, I'm not sure, well, is that right? I really wouldn't trust it unless I put it in a supercomputer, so I'm sort of on the other side. Returning to the USA, Pauling became one of the first people to apply the new theories of quantum mechanics to molecular structure with a view of understanding chemistry. He used his confidence in the study as an explanation of bonds between atoms. So, yeah, Lewis has the Lewis dot diagrams that's taught in schools, and unfortunately it creates an intellectual dead end for everyone. The nature of the chemical bond. It's now already known that atoms could combine by forming bonds that were either ionic or covalent. Pauling was to do away with this neat oversimplification, so he has the electronegativity. He began publishing his work of the chemical bonds in 1931, and a second visit to Europe in which he learned how to use electron diffraction similar to X-ray diffraction by using a beam of electrons. The paper was one more than 50 that Pauling had published yet. He was still only 30 years old. In recognition of his astonishing energy and brilliance, he was awarded the Longmuir Prize as the most promising young scientist in the United States. Pauling's book, summarizing the work on bonds published in 1939, became the most influential, widely read chemical book on chemistry. By bringing quantum mechanics into the explanation of bonding, he explained how and why elements from a compound and material behave as they do. Oh, well. Yeah, I think ionic bonds, or the ionic character, the Pauling ionic scale. Pauling used X-rays and electrons, and it's interesting that we at school teach ionic or covalent, and it's, you know, this pre-1931. Pauling used X-rays and electron diffraction, looked at the magnetic effects, and measured the heat of chemical reactions to calculate the distances and angles between atomic bonds. Described hybridization following the label of ionic covalent are a little more than a convenience to group bonds, which really allow a continuous spectrum of the wholly ionic to wholly covalent. Okay, well, okay. He introduced the concept of electronegativity as a measure of the attraction between atoms, and so he's got a Pauling scale, which for some reason is 0 to 4, okay, units, but 0 to 4, but due to calculation errors, it's 0 to 3.98. I wonder if, that's right. And I don't wonder if they have it here. He introduced the concept of electronegativity as a measure of the attraction between the atoms and electrons involved in bond, and developed a table of values for different atoms. The electronegativity scales let us say how covalent and ionic a bond is. That's between two atoms, mind you. If you've got three atoms, you've got, you know. Finally, Pauling examined the way which carbon forms bond. The carbon had four filled and four unfilled electron shells. No, even that's incorrect. Four and unfilled, orbitals, he meant. In a shell, there's a hybridized orbital or something, I don't know. That's just bad. That's just a mistake within a mistake. Making it possible for a myriad of organic compounds found in plants and animals. The concept of hybridization proved useful in explaining the way carbon bonds often fall between recognized states. That's complete and utter. I mean, even within the school textbooks, that's complete rubbish. And the problem is that this is an accessible book where everything's read in a sort of semi-religious way, where you have the lives of the saints, you know, the way we were taught in religion. In terms of theologies enough, oh, let's hear about how a few Jesuits got tortured by the in South America and boiled alive. Okay, we'll go back to chemical bonds. This is just appalling, this book. Building blocks of life. Pauling work on carbon and opened the door for a realm of organic chemistry. Organic compounds are carbon-based chemicals from which all life forms on Earth are based. Inspired by X-ray. Now, the interesting thing is that the Pauli electronegativity is outside quantum mechanics, and he gets a little bit into quantum mechanics, but he misses the whole quantum mechanics of the periodic table. Organic compounds are carbon-based chemicals which all life forms on Earth are based. Inspired by X-ray photographs of organic compounds produced by Alfred Ashby in England, Pauling turned his attention in the 1930s to the structure of complex organic molecules, an area previously of no interest to him. X-ray diffraction alone was not a very useful tool for determining the structure of complex organic molecules, but it can now can show the great general shape of a molecule. Pauling, but this is only at a very high level, that if a molecule has a symmetry, so does the X-ray diffraction have a symmetry. So, like, if it's less polarizing, it's quite interesting. Okay, sometimes they moved around simple flat shapes on paper. Often they needed more complex three-dimensional models. And this is where, if you look at eucalyptus oil, the turpentines, the things where your bonds go three-dimensional, it's just such a joy. And, of course, you're branching amino acids and stuff like that in general. Okay. The work was productive. Pauling demonstrated the structure of hemoglobin, which carries oxygen in the blood, changes when the oxygen is attached to it. Which is a brilliant theme. However, it's so much more complicated than that in terms of the oxygen molecule spinning around. It has to break it, and it's got to transfer angular momentum. So obviously, say if you're a pitcher and you catch a ball and it's got in your glove and it can't bounce out again, you've got to have a way that oscillation then shakes off water molecules, if that makes sense. So you've got to actually have oxygen come in and lock, and then water molecules come off. And it's really interesting, the hydrogen bonding, the structures and the vibrations. He was one of the first people to explain how antibodies and enzymes work. His work showed physical chemistry at the molecular level could be used to solve problems in biology and medicine. But the main challenge of biochemists was to understand proteins, the chemicals that control and process of the cell. Again, Pauling's work was a great progress. This is interesting, I don't know. And this is so sad, because this is incorrectly explained previously. You wonder in your head that if I want to take this on, do I take this for real? Unfortunately, a lot of people who are not trained basically go to a lecture, have a beer, go to a party, get a job, whatever it is, and go back to the next lecture. They're not concentrating on the lecture between lectures, and they're not reading books either side and saying, oh, hang on, this mustn't be right. The hydrogen bond is a special type of bond formed between a hydrogen atom and a nearby atom of a negative charge, C panel. Oh dear. Pauling did not discover it. The strange behaviour of some atoms around hydrogen had been observed before, but he did explain it in terms of quantum behaviour and worked out the value for the energy involved. Once explained, it became clear that life on Earth depends existence on small, weak bond, and in many places the chemical jigsaw could last fall into place. What I want to say is that a hydrogen bond is basically a bond with a proton rather than an electron. End of story. Thanks very much. So, a hydrogen bond, if the electron is quantum mechanical, a hydrogen is a bit more classical bond. It's much easier to see it in that way. So, in fact, perhaps the best way into chemistry is to go through hydrogen bonds first. Round and round. Pauling worked with Alan Mirsky over an extended period interrupted by the Second World War to discover the structure of proteins. William Lawrence's Baggs team at Cavendish at Cambridge University UK was working on the same problem. This time it looked like though Bragg would get there first, but when he published his findings in 1950, it was clear that they were not quite right. Pauling came up with the correct answer, published the following year, and characteristic shape of protein, a long chain twisted in a... Long chain twisted into a helix or spiral, now known as the alpha helix. The structure held shape by hydrogen bonds. It's also explained the beta sheet, a pleated sheet of arrangements given strength by a line of hydrogen bonds. In May 1951, Pauline's team stunned the biochemical world by publishing the structure of 7 pre-fibrous proteins, including hair, silk, and muscle. I think that's what he's talking about more than anything. Oh, dear. So, why is Francis Crick, why is there a picture of Rosalind Franklin? They're giving you a team there. The biggest and most complex biochemical DNA, this substance which forms chromosomes, are made in structure. It encodes all characteristics of living organisms. Tackling the structure of DNA was an obvious next step for Alliance Pauline and Bragg, but neither of them would win the race. Instead, the prize went to a British team of Crick and Watson. Yeah. Pacifists and activists. This is probably more the most accurate so far. Pauline, along with many other leading scientists, had been asked to join the Manhattan Project to develop the atomic weapon during the Second World War. He had once been a close friend with the leader of the project, Robert Oppenheimer. Through their friendship, it had become an abrupt end after Oppenheimer tried to persuade Pauline's wife to run away to Mexico with him. Fuck. Oh, sorry, that's amazing. But it was Pauline's pacifism that made it impossible for him to take part and led to his difficulties with US authorities in the year after the war as he campaigned relentlessly to control nuclear arms. His passport was confiscated in 1952 and returned just in time for him to travel to Stockholm and to collect the Nobel Prize for Chemistry in 1954. In fact, the loss of his passport prevented him from visiting England and seeing Rosalind Franklin's X-ray of DNA. That might have led him to, rather than Crick and Watson, to reveal the correct structure of DNA, the double helix rather than the triple helix Pauline was suggested. Now that is interesting. That is a fascinating little thing. So having someone run off you with your home economics wife and then to Mexico, you mentioned, this is enough, more than enough. Pauline's campaigned tirelessly to ban above-ground nuclear testing and control nuclear weapons around the world. In 1958, he and his wife collected and presented the United Nations petition calling for the end of weapons testing, and was signed more than 11,000 scientists. The public pressure after this led to the partial test ban treaty signed in 1963 by the United States and Russia. On the day the treaty was signed, Pauline was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. It did nothing to help his position at home. His department at Caltech, still wary of his involvement, did not congratulate him, and only the biology department held a small party for him. The Internal Security Subcommittee called him the number one scientific name in virtually every major activity of the Communist Party offensive in his country. Life magazine called his prize an extraordinary insult to America. Later in his life, Pauline turned his attention to alternative medicine. This is where he's just a complete wacko. In particular, promoting the doses of vitamin C as a way of avoiding cancer. Pauline died, ironically, of prostate cancer in 1994, and it's a ranch near Big Sur, California. He was 93, so what a nice man. It's pretty amazing. Covalent bonds. The covalent bond was one or more electrons that shared between two atoms. This is just... it's all para... atomic power, quantum mechanics. So two hydrogen atoms of a hydrogen molecule, H2, by sharing each single electron. But see, they have the same... So the point is that if they've got the same electron negativity, they have a completely covalent bond. If they have different electron negativity, so a Na2 molecule and hydrogen molecule and chlorine oil are equally covalent by this scheme because of the same electronegativity. Let's read it. Two atoms bound together by shared electrons, and this was proposed by Gilbert Lewis and Ivan Lungmann in 1916. Oh dear. In the ionic bond, one atom gives away one or more electrons to another atom. So, a common salt, sodium chloride, sodium gives away its spare electron to chlorine. As the electron is not shared, the sodium and chlorine are not bound together in a molecule. However, losing electron, sodium acquires a, so it's actually not a chemical bond, it's an ionic bond. You know, it's the positive charge in the sodium nucleus is attracted to the electron, which is held within, you know, through the center of the chlorine nucleus. This is crazy. However, by losing electrons, sodium acquires positive charge, chlorine by gaining electron acquires a negative charge. And see, again, this is poor because they don't talk about electron affinity here. The resulting sodium and chlorine ions are held together by crystalline structure. Until Pauling's explanation, it was thought that they were held in place by electrical charges, the negative and positive ions being drawn to each other. That's just crazy. That's so sad to read. Now, the hydrogen bond. When the hydrogen atom forms the bond with an atom, which strongly attracts a single electron, I suppose, a little negative charge is left on the opposite side of the hydrogen atom. As there are no other electrons orbiting the hydrogen atom, the other side of the atom is a notably positive charge. From the proton nucleus, this is just sad. This makes me weak. This attracts nearby atoms with a negative charge. The attraction, called the hydrogen bond, is about a tenth of the strength of a covalent bond. Now, the hydrogen proton actually translates. I mean, there's just so much evidence that this is not the case. So, a drop of deuterium in a swimming pool, within milliseconds, that deuterium will spread throughout the pool, not because it's changing, it's just due to the nature of the hydrogen bond being an exchange of protons. So you've got very good physical evidence that this explanation is rubbish. Let's listen to this. It's going to go into it. In water, attraction between the hydrogen atoms in one water molecule and the oxygen atom in another water molecule makes the water molecule sticky. It gives a regular crystalline structure that would otherwise not have. No, I think the quantum shape of the oxygen orbitals give it structure. It makes water liquid at room temperature, and the other compounds, which are similarly small molecules, are gases at room temperature. I think it's just missing out a huge amount of chemistry, and this makes it difficult for me as a quantum physicist. When you're teaching in a school, you don't know, you just give the explanation as it is, but the people in the classrooms next to you really genuinely don't know and give bogus explanations, and then they get in charge and do the marks. Pauling took from quantum mechanics the idea of an electron having both wavelet and particle-like properties and applied it to the hydrogen bonds. Oh my god. Instead of there being just one electrical attraction between the water molecules, Pauling suggested that the wave properties of the particles involved in the hydrogen bonding and those involved in the covalent bonding overlap. This gives the hydrogen bond some of the properties of covalent bonds. It is finally proven correct in experimental evidence in 1999. Well, okay. I don't know how. Okay, the DNA team. Let's see what the timing is here for. We have done 20 minutes on Pauling. Very interesting person. Just gives you an example of, you know, what hope do we have in science as we have the great scientists. And these people it just stuns me to think that I'm out here, there's only one of me, but there are millions of these books of this quality and millions of teachers. I just don't have a hope. Okay, so this is not a scientist, this is a team. Francis Crick, James Watson, and Rosalind Franklin. You have to put her in. Rosalind Franklin died in 58. Crick died in 2004. James Watson is still alive, born in 28. DNA is probably the most famous molecule in the world. I would say it is. Its double helix shape and single most familiar image of biology and chemistry. It's discovered Francis Crick, James Watson, and more controversially by Rosalind Franklin. Well, why you just put her name and controversy right next to it as soon as you read it, I just think is part of the horror of it all. The discovery of the structure of DNA and the possibilities it's opened up have brought complex science to public consciousness as much as any other scientific advance of the 20th century. I agree with that. Understanding how DNA work helped us to unravel the mechanism of inheritance, explaining how organisms inherit characteristics from their parents and ancestors, expanded made possible by new chemical treatments, controversial techniques as genetic engineering, cloning, screening for genetic diseases, and DNA fingerprinting. I think we'd have to say CRISPR in there now. What is it? CRISPR. Clustered repeating interspaced palindromic repeats. I haven't got quite what that is. Saying the same, the understanding of the inheritance began with Carl Gregor Mendel in the 1850s, who saw the patterns of how characteristics are passed through generations of pea plants. And it's also interesting how he was just treated like dog shit. Later in the 19th century, other scientists saw chromosomes and discovered DNA in the cells. But it was not until 1914 that Oswald Avery realized that DNA has carried the information that controls inheritance. Okay, but also around this time, you have Schrodinger saying it's an aperiodic crystal you're looking for. The work of Linus Pauling and William Bragg and others on the structure of proteins in the 1940s set the stage for exploring the structure of DNA. Pauling had revealed the molecular structure of biological molecules account for their chemical behavior. It was clear that understanding DNA enables the plants and animals to pass on genetic traits could only be based on the knowledge of its molecular structure. The race was on to discover its structure. Open competition. In the United States, Pauling led the most experienced, best-financed research team. In the UK, the effort was split between the laboratory at King College in London and the Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge. The two British groups had different approaches. In London, Rosalind Franklin and Morris Wilkins were working on X-ray images of DNA molecules, trying to work out the structure mathematically. In Cambridge, Francis Crick and James Watson made models of possible structures that would accommodate that was known about the chemical composition of DNA and the structure subunits already identified in other large molecules. The breakthrough came only when the fruits of both approaches were combined. That's lovely. Put that down. I'd love if he had this original structure. Cambridge. James Dewey Watson, born in Chicago, 6th of April, 28. He was always an inquisitive child. This is about him. And would not be silenced by a simple answer to a question. He spent a lot of his time bird watching with his father, and his first ambition was to be an ornithologist. Is he the one that's still alive? Yeah. After his doctorate, he moved to Copenhagen to study the effect of DNA on viruses. Of DNA, he became interested in the X-ray crystallography and being used to reveal the shapes of complex molecules. As the best X-ray crystallography work was being done in England at the time, he set off to learn more, ending up in Cavendish's laboratory in Cambridge. So you've got to really always watch these academics coming in. They come in and steal your work. Looking at lines. Oh, I think they're photographs rather than lines. You get lines from... I think this is bizarre. The technique of X-ray crystallography had been developed in 1912 by William and Lawrence Bragg, a father and son team. Working in England, the Braggs discovered if X-rays were directed at crystalline structure, a regular pattern of lines was produced, or dots, you really mean. The X-rays were scattered by striking atoms in the crystal or by passing straight through. Oh, this is, well, when there's no atoms to the path, that's just so wrong. It's disgusting that I'm reading this in a book. Thank goodness I picked up this book at a church fete. Or it was given to me. I can't remember. Using X-rays of known wavelengths, diffraction patterns, the pattern of lines, it could be used to work out the arrangement of atoms and crystals. Well, it's actually spots, mind you. My God, Father. three-dimensional spots, X-ray, you need a two-dimensional cut. Your two-dimensional cut is through a sphere in momentum in space. And they really don't understand this. X-ray crystallography is the interpretation of X-ray diffraction patterns in order to discover the structure of crystals and molecules. It was first applied by biological molecules by Linus Pauling. While his colleague, Cambridge, Francis Crompton Creek, came into biology relatively late in life, born in North England, June 1916, he was an inquisitive child with a passionate interest in scientists. He read all the science books he could get hold of and experimented at home in the kitchen. He studied physics at the University of College in London and worked at the Admiralty on mines during the Second World War. After the war, he looked around for something more interesting to do. He went first to Strangeways Laboratory in Cambridge and soon after moved to Cambridge to study proteins. When Watson moved to Cambridge, the two immediately became firm friends. He shared his office together, although both were supposed to be concentrating on the projects. Their shared interest in DNA led their work together of bombing construction. You can imagine, and this is, you know, so often in society, they're so busy hammering scientists, and I can say that scientists, at least in Australian culture, are completely hammered, and you very rarely just get around to buck around with friends. And now, looking at the Lions versus London, it says, versus London. To call the pair working in London a team implies a degree of cooperation that did not exist. Maurice Hugh Frederick Wilkins was born in Paranga, New Zealand, in 1916. He moved to England at the age of six, and later he studied physics at Cambridge University. During the Second World War, he worked at the time at the Manhattan Project in the United States. After the war, he returned to Britain. He worked as first as physics lecturer at St Andrews University, Fife, Scotland, and then moved to King's College to work at the biological molecules, including DNA and viruses. Rosalind Elsie Franklin was born in London on the 25th of July, 1920. She was a brilliant child and from a prosperous background meant that she was lucky enough to go to one of the few schools that taught physics and chemistry for girls at the time. Her father discouraged her ambitions to become a scientist, even so she went to Cambridge University and went to chemistry in 1938. After finishing her degree, she spent a year in Cambridge but gave up at work in industry studying the physical structure of coal. In 1947, she moved to Paris where she learned about X-ray crystallography. She returned to England in 1951 and was given a job at Wilkins Laboratory in King's College. Unfortunately, she was employed while Wilkins was away and they got off to a bad start and returned. She assumed she was assistant rather than his peer, appointed to work at the same problem as she was really exploring. The relationship only deteriorated. Look, can I say there's just, there's so many jerks in science you can't do, and it's not that the jerks are racist or anti-women or they're jerks, right? I would say the first. Working methods. Franklin's six-phase photographs were brilliant, the best produced by anyone. She enjoyed additional good luck of having access to the best sample of DNA in the world. This had been derived from the thalamus glands of calves by Swiss scientists and generously given to Wilkins. Now, undiplomatically, it was handed over to Franklin by the director of the laboratory, John Randall. So he stepped in. X-ray crystallography can show the general shape of a molecule, but not the type of atoms in each molecule in it. Creel Watson tried a more physical models of structural DNA by first using cardboard cutouts and then metal plates, screws and rods. Coloured balls represent atoms of the bond. Now, it's deoxy. The ribose has got the oxygen of it, which allows them to go. So it's deoxyribose. So you've got ribose, and if you take the OH bonds out and just put them with hydrogens in there, get the deoxy, which gives you the flat plate structure. The aim was to piece together possible arrangements between them. The aim was In the United States, Pauling was doing much the same thing. His unrivaled knowledge of chemical bonds could have given him the edge, but he was hampered by having poor quality X-ray images to work on. And what's the other thing? And his passport was also taken away. The idea of the structure was some form of helix had already gained ground. So I knew, this is quite a lot. Pauling had already discovered the alpha helix structure of protein, and early photographs could be interpreted as supporting theory. Franklin, however, dismissed the idea that the helix was the key to structure along with the practice of making models, which she derived by preferring her own methods of experiment and measurements. A poor thing. Stumbling progress. Watson first saw Franklin in 51 when she was presenting some of her X-ray photographs and showed some basic shapes of the DNA strands and meeting in London. He did not pay enough attention to be able to use the information properly, though Crick and Watson built a molecule based on Watson's imperfect recollection of Franklin's evidence, which showed the molecule as a triple helix. It was badly flawed, and Franklin gleefully pointed out to them when they demonstrated the molecule. A better knowledge of chemistry might have saved them from the humiliation and mistakes. Watson and Crick suggested to join forces with Franklin, but she refused. The director of Cavendish, embarrassed by the exasperated, told the pair to stop working on DNA and leave the problem to the London laboratory. They pretended to comply. Franklin continued to work on her own idea structure, largely alone, as she could not cooperate with Hilkins. She had identified two forms of DNA varying with humidity. She set aside most of her stunning photographs in wet form, which she called Photo 51, as she was more interested in the dry form. Okay, so the wet form is with the full... Wet form is the hydrogen bombs in the inside, isn't it? So wet form is... You've got lots of hydrogen molecules getting in the side. Linus Pauling worked in the United States without the benefit of Franklin's X-rays. Photographs came up with a triple helix structure in January 53. He wrote to his son working in Cavendish with the news and sent him a draft of his paper exploring the structure. Crick and Watson first distraught at being the beautiful answer. They believed to see Pauling had got it wrong, making the same mistake they had done earlier. Breakthrough. Before leaving King's College to work at Biblic on viruses, Franklin gave a final seminar in which she stressed her belief the structure of DNA was not a helix. Watson visited her a few days later to show her Pauling's paper, but the two quarrelled. Afraid she was going to hit him, Watson left quickly. He bumped into Wilkins, who had already frustrated by the delay. Wilkins showed him Franklin's best photograph, probably photograph 51, without her knowledge. It clearly showed the structure was a helix. The instant I saw the picture, my mouth fell open and my pulse began to race, Watson remembered. He sketched it He sketched what he had seen in the margin of the newspaper on the train back to Cambridge. It took it the month to Crick and Watson to perfect the model after that. Famous double helix, Watson and Crick's model shows a double helix made of two joint... this is so bad. I don't think... You've got to also understand that... women are either pushed over or given as good as they get. Crick and Watson's final model showed the double helix made of two joined chains from nucleotides. Two outside strands are held together by the same distance of pairs of nucleotide bases interlocking in the center, acting like a rung on a ladder. The bases are always paired in the same way, adenine, thymine, guanine, cytosine. Revealing the structure of DNA did indeed show how it works. The two strands separate, then each acts as a template, allowing the others to regenerate. Here, the adrenaline appears, the thymine must be the opposite, and so on. Cells divide. So you've got the... you've got to understand... You've got the base pair. The actual unit of DNA is not the actual base. It's the phosphate ribose base. I don't know what this is called. Moving on, Crick was awarded the PhD in chemistry in 1953 and continued to work for the mechanism of DNA in Washington until 1966, when he returned to embryology. Later, he followed up an early interest in how the brain works and turned his attention to consciousness and neural networks. In later life, he came to champion some less mainstream, often unpopular ideas. These included the theory that life on Earth originated from outer space and sent there by intelligent beings on unmanned rockets, and his belief that the knowledge of genetics could be used to perfect the human race. He died, thankfully, I shouldn't say, in 2004. So he was a bit of a neo-Nazi. Watson continued to work, how weird is that? Continued to work on genetics, teaching the United States at Harvard and Caltech. He became the head of human genetics projects in 88 and used to go around the oceans in a boat collecting DNA. It wasn't beautiful. Wilkins continued to teach at London until and to campaign against nuclear weapons and died in 2004 as well. Despite never receiving credit for her role in solving the mystery of DNA, Franklin was pleased that the structure had been discovered. She worked on the viruses at Biblical College until her early death from cancer in 1958. Nobel Prize, but not for all. The structure of DNA was demonstrated by Crick and Watson was accepted immediately. But at the time the Nobel Prize was awarded, the work Watson and Franklin had died. Nobel Prizes are not given posthumously. Okay. And it may well be they wouldn't have given it to her. The portion of the prize which might otherwise have been hers was awarded to Morris Wilkins, along with Crick and James Watson. Oh, dear. That's really bad, the structure of DNA. I love the structure of DNA. Okay, we're getting up to Stephen Hawking, and he's the last one of this book. And I'm getting a bit tired here. It's 46 minutes. And he's the last one. So Hawking's gone. So this book is just out of date. It's 42. That's really good. And Hawking, he's very famous. I love the idea that he thought of black holes within the sun. I think that was a good idea. But he, again, really wasn't up on quantum physics. Stephen Hawking, the English cosmologist. Stephen Hawking, 1942 to now, I think last year, 2018, is one of the leading scientists alive today or dead today. His brilliant work on black holes in space and the Big Bang has profoundly influenced our understanding of the universe. A century ago, astronomers believed the universe was a little bigger than our own Milky Way of stars and was completely stable and unchanging. But over the first few decades of the 20th century, the view profoundly shaken. First of all, the powerful telescopes reveal there are countless galaxies beyond the Milky Ways, I think. Something like 2 trillion, something like that, galaxies. There's 2 trillion stars in the Milky Way and 2 trillion galaxies in the universe. And trillion is a number to really get your handle on. In the 1920s, the great American astronomer Edwin Hubble discovered that all these galaxies were speeding away from us, which means that far from being stable, the universe must be expanding at a phenomenal rate. Meanwhile, two great concepts, quantum physics and Einstein's theory of general relativity, turned classical physics, the 17th century physics of Newton, on its head. Well, just said it's not a theory, it's not saying it's wrong, it's just a description. The extraordinary ideas only gradually made a general impact on the world of science, but a number of scientists immediately saw some of the implications. In 1917, for instance, 10 years before Hubble observed the expansion of the universe, the Russian astronomer Alexei Friedman inferred the expansion from Einstein's relativity. Einstein actually disagreed with Friedman and was shocked when Hubble's discovery proved Friedman right. Well, that's really not quite correct. As it happened, it's a nice way of getting English quickly. As it happened, it was already the second time Einstein's own interpretation of relativity had been challenged, again rightly, as it turned out. A year earlier, in 1916, a German astronomer, Karl Schwarzschild, used Einstein's theory to work out what happens if a star collapses under the force of its own gravity. Schwarzschild's Schwarzschild concluded that the star contracts its gravity grows so powerful that nothing, not even light, can escape. This is one of the things, is you've got inverse square law, and against that you've got quantum physics stopping things collapsing. And you should do. It becomes a black hole in space. Such a hole is later found to be centered on a minute point called a singularity. Or, I don't know whether you could say a singularity is a point. Well, I suppose you could say it is a mathematical point. Where time and all forces come to one. What do we mean by that? I don't know where they say that means. The size of the star, which must shrink to become a black hole, is called appropriately the Schwarzschild. Ah, okay. The Schwarzschild radius for a particular mass is something like that. That's really poorly expressed. I'll read it to you again. The size to which a star must shrink before it becomes a black hole is called appropriately the Schwarzschild radius and is about 3 kilometers for a star the size of our sun. Okay. Well, now I've heard it done for any mass, of a particular mass. Over the next half century, scientists began mathematically to wind back the clock of the expanding universe and realized that, although it is now big, it must have been small. The theory must have burst into existence and swelled outwards about 13 billion years ago, or 13.8 billion years ago, when it was called the Big Bang. The Big Bang theory soon be firmly established, even though the understanding of the process was involved with shaking. Black holes, however, remained controversial. After all, they could not, by definition, be seen. We can now see them, of course. Some Soviet scientists argue that they could not exist at all because they depend on the star collapsing perfectly symmetrically, which they argued is highly unlikely. However, if you want symmetric collapse, your symmetry of these butterfly nebula, the beautiful patterns of the nebula, is due to the symmetric collapse. So I think there are mechanisms for symmetry. Significantly, while Einstein's relativity have played a key part in both the Big Bang and the black hole theories, it's interesting how they've got Big Bang and small letters and black hole big letters. The great revolution idea of quantum physics seemed almost to have been sidelined to relevant cosmology. This is because it apparently refers to only minute subatomic level and cannot scale the universe. It was Stephen Hawking's brilliant insight that brought the Big Bang and black holes, relatively quantum physics, all together. They have an extraordinary theory of a picture of how cosmic thought forces work. First of all, the undergraduate Hawking realized that the Big Bang might be a black hole in reverse, expanding from a singularity. That's beautiful. This gave cosmologists the mathematical tools to develop a fuller picture of the origins of the universe. Then, in early 1970s, Hawking realized the quantum effect might also apply to the event horizon of the Reno black hole. And this is controversial, obviously. If they did, he argued, they'd make black holes glow faintly. This is your matter-antimatter pair and the dividing on the event horizon, and so your matter basically leaks out, doesn't it? First of all, yeah, I find it really hard to understand myself. The goal here, Hawking radiation. Even more importantly, by bringing quantum physics into the study of black holes, Hawking had drawn into the whole cosmic field, and so opened the way for all-embracing physical theory of the universe. It was that Hawking and his colleagues are looking at the moment. Okay, well, I don't know. It's also really interesting about the structure of matter and Higgs boson. I think you've got to talk about that. Bright little boffin. Stephen Hawking was only famous not just for his cosmological theories, but his terrible disease, which left him completely paralyzed and only able to speak with a synthesized voice. The degenerative disease that paralyzed him is called amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS, which damages the nerve cells of the spinal cord and controls the body's voluntary muscles. When diagnosed with the disease in the 1960s-72, Hawking was given just a few years to live. Although the disease has progressed, he has defied all expectations and remained alive, except he's now dead. And it's clear his mind, clear in his mind as ever. Well, you don't know. When he was a child, he was a little sign of the disease. He was born on January 8th, 1942 in Oxford, where his parents moved temporarily to escape the London Blitz. His date of birth was coincidentally the 300th anniversary of Galileo's death and close to the 100th anniversary of Newton's birth.
Daddy!
Yes, hon?
I'm going now.
Okay. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.